National Weather Service. Gradual clearing skies today, a high around 75. West winds around 15, gusting as high as 25. Partly cloudy tonight, a low around 50. Sunny tomorrow, a high of 67. Expanded forecast, showers and storms likely on Friday, a high of 73. Partly sunny on Saturday, a high of 62. A chance of some showers and storms Sunday morning. Sunday's high, 69. Right now, 66. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we talk about something which I suspect is near and dear to many of you, board games. And we're going to be talking to someone who loves board games probably more than all the rest of us put together. His name is Ian Livingston. He has more than 1,000 games in his own personal collection. He co-wrote the game book series Fighting Fantasy, co-founder of the games company Games Workshop, and is responsible for a new book called Board Games in 100 Moves, 8,000 Years of Play, which covers the thousands of years in which human beings in one way or another have been playing board games. And we will find out a little bit about what is ahead as we continue to sail into the 21st century playing games of all different types. Ian Livingston, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, good morning.
Tell us, first of all, where did your own love of board games begin? Are we talking about typical games that children love, like Candyland and the like?
Well, it wasn't Candyland. In fact, Candyland was not very popular in the UK. It was a huge USA phenomenon.
Ah.
So my love of games started at school with playing games like Monopoly. I also played chess for the school. And I never stopped playing. You know, you're never too young to start. I don't think you're ever too old to stop playing games. And when I moved to London, I shared a flat with two old school friends, and we all shared an interest in games and played them all the time and thought, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow turn our hobby of playing games into a business? And that's how Games Workshop started, and we actually launched Dungeons & Dragons in Europe back in 1975. But I just love everything about games. You know, play is natural. When we arrive in this world, we learn through play. We interact through play, and it's just a great battle of wits between like-minded people.
Very good. How would you use this term when we're talking about games that we play in a sense on a table or sitting around various chairs in a circle versus something that we play on a screen? When a game is actually on a screen on our tablet or our phone, in your mind, is it still a board game or is it a different kind of game?
It's still play. And play in human terms is that as we create rules so we can decide that we have winners. You know, animals in nature don't have rules, they just play. But we like to win. So whether it's on a screen or on a board, we like to have winners and we like to achieve and make deals and interact and have all that social fun playing together. And there's actually been a huge rise in board games, a revival in board games, strangely, at the time when video games have never been so popular. I mean, the global industry now for video games $150 billion a year, but at the same time board games have been revived thanks to Kickstarter, where people can get games made through crowdfunding. They can learn how to play online through various board game sites. There are review sites. And, of course, e-commerce. People can buy games through Amazon and the like. So there's never been a better time to access board games and have this great enjoyment in, with people you enjoy playing with. And also, which is quite strange as well, is that, well, not strange, I think, is that it's a reaction to, if everything is digital, we feel as humans that something is lacking. We like physical. So there's also been a revival in vinyl, and there's been a revival in physical books, and, of course, there's been a revival in board games.
One of the most astonishing aspects of your book is that it helps us understand what a long history we are talking about, far longer than I think the average person would ever imagine. Explain just a little bit about the very earliest evidence we have of human beings doing this kind of play and what kind of artifacts survive to sort of point the way to this.
Well, games played on stone, where we used to play, you know, thousands of years ago, scratching game boards into the dirt and using sticks and stones as pieces. But the rules were never written down, of course, so we've no idea how those games were played. But then in the Middle East, from around about 8,000 years ago, there were stone boards dug up again, but with no pieces. But the first earliest recorded board game is a game called Senet, which dates back from 5,000 years ago. You know, long before the wheel was invented, we were playing games. And games like Senet was a race game, moving pieces along a board, were enjoyed by the Egyptians and everybody in the Middle East. And in fact, Tutankhamun had four sets of Senet in his tomb when it was discovered. And so it's not a recent phenomenon, but it has been a great boom in recent years, and particularly in the United States, being some fantastic, well-known inventors and, of course, publishers of board games that we know today, like Monopoly and Candyland, as you mentioned, and Scrabble. But I think it just reflects culture and human beings love to play together.
Mm. One of the hallmarks of your book is that it takes us, in a sense, behind the scenes as some of the most iconic games in history have been created. And in several instances, we are talking about games that became supremely popular and successful, but which had, in one reason or another, very halting beginnings. And in one or two cases, we're talking about blockbuster best-selling games that nearly never got out of the starting gate. Maybe you could share with our listeners a couple of your favorite stories about some of these slow starters that ultimately became real champions in the history of board games.
Well, of course, I just mentioned Monopoly a few minutes ago. Is that that actually was a derivative of a game called The Landlord's Game, which was designed by a woman called Elizabeth McGee, who manufactured a few sets herself in around about 1903. She didn't have much success with it. She patented the game, showed it to Parker Brothers, who rejected it. And it was a little bit abstract, to be honest. But nevertheless, it had a certain appeal because this was the very first game where things actually happened on the board. Before The Landlord's Game, all the Victorian games had just been simple race games where you roll a dice and move your piece around the board, and that was about it. There was no strategy, and it was just pure luck. But with The Landlord's Game, you could actually develop the piece. You could buy or rent properties on the board. But tragically, it was never a success. But Charles Darrow, who lived in Pennsylvania, he'd got himself a copy, or he'd seen a copy of the game and made his own copy. And there were a lot of derivative games created at the time, and Charles Darrow called his game Monopoly, and he developed it, and he added local place names to the squares, and it was a lot more kind of user-friendly, and showed it to Parker Brothers. Long story short, they bought the rights to it, and they subsequently bought any remaining rights that Elizabeth McGee had. And, of course, we all know, you know, Monopoly went on to become a huge multinational success story all over the world, and Charles Darrow did very well out of it, whereas Elizabeth McGee not so much. Scrabble is another case that was almost, you know, it was made by designers. They couldn't get games made. Alfred Butz made a few copies, didn't sell, and in the end licensed the game, and it was a huge success. I think one of the most funny stories is Twister. It was originally called Pretzel, and Milton Bradley got hold of it, and they were about to discontinue it, but their PR company had already booked a series of shows for it to appear on, including the Johnny Carson show. And he played Twister with Eva Gabor, and it was instantly sold out the next day all over the United States, and they ended up having to print like 40,000 a week just to keep up with the demand for a game that was about to be discontinued. So it's quite amusing that some of the biggest titles were almost never made it.
Mm. One thing that is interesting to me is how one can go into a game store and be confronted by literally hundreds of games, and yet we're really not talking about hundreds of different games. We're talking about maybe several huge genres, of which there are many variations. How many genres are we talking about that have spawned many games within them?
Well, there's lots of genres and subgenres these days. You know, years ago, it was simple race games, as I described, moving your piece around the board. Then things started to happen on the board, and then decided to have more themes attached to the game. So you started having war games and business games and word games. And then beyond that, the strategy or the abstract games became subsets of worker placement games, games like card games where you're building a deck, and so there's more and more subsectors as people try to find a new genre in which to exploit. I mean, last year at Essen in Germany, they had 180,000 people attend the show, and nearly 2,000 new games were launched. Now, clearly, not all those are going to be successful, but people are so excited about the possibility of new gaming franchise coming along that they're motivated to create new games. And again, one of the most successful titles in recent years was Ticket to Ride, invented by Alan Moon in the US. You know, they sold millions and millions of copies, and this is a very elegant railway game where you're building rides, you're taking your trains across initially the United States, and now they've got maps for all parts of Europe and the rest of the world. So there's great potential to be successful in board games today.
Right.
The power of the internet.
And I think there's nothing more exciting than when you find a brand new game that really is new, not just another variation on Trivial Pursuit or another variation on something else you've played, but a game that has truly never existed before. And your book kind of helps us explore what it takes to create that kind of a game. In your own considerable collection, is there a particular game that you especially prize, maybe because it is particularly rare or valuable?
Well, I wouldn't keep it for its value alone. I would keep one for the enjoyment it gives, because you know I buy games because I like them, not because they're going to increase in value over time. And trying to choose one, I've always asked this question. It's a bit like asking me what's my favorite child, and I've got four. So I think the one I'd have to keep would be an original Dungeons & Dragons set, which is still in its shrink wrap, which I got many, many years ago. Back in, say, we launched Dungeons & Dragons in Europe in 1975.
Wow.
So I guess it would be that.
And how about, is there a favorite game that you and your children enjoy playing together?
Not all my children enjoy playing games. I mean, some of them are growing up now, but of course. But we liked playing Dungeons & Dragons. We liked playing Monopoly, some of the classics. But the Ticket to Ride was one. Carcassonne was another. Catan was another. More recently, we've been playing a game called Splendor. But there's always something for everybody in the family. But talking about classics, you know, classics only come along every now and then. Ones that kind of milestones in gaming history, and that's what we tried to describe in the book about the way Monopoly changed the landscape, how Scrabble changed the landscape, how Dungeons and Dragons changed the landscape.
Hmm.
And then, you know, we know there's going to be more in the future, but we're not too sure when or what it will be.
That's part of what makes it all exciting. Where would we be without our wonderful games? And your book helps us explore all of that. Board Games and 100 Moves, 8,000 Years of Play, published by DK. Ian Livingston, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for giving the world this wonderful book.
Thank you very much indeed. Life is a game.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. And for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we talk sports, and we debunk some famous legends and myths in the world of sports and sports histories, courtesy of a really interesting book called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. The author of the book, Sheldon Hirsch, who calls himself a sports geek, is someone who has not only been fascinated in with sports, has played sports himself, but also been really intrigued by the way in which certain events are blown radically out of proportion, or certain complex stories are boiled down into very oversimplistic generalizations, tidying up some of the messier realities about, for instance, the teams we follow or the athletes that we venerate. And frankly, he's had enough of it and vents his frustration and offers some clarification in this really interesting new book in which he talks about some of the legends and myths and so on that have sprung up and are scarcely given a second glance. But he really wants us to think about some of this more carefully. And but don't mistake this description. This is not a dry, uninteresting book. This book is entertaining start to finish. And even if at the end one ends up learning a lot about some of the assumptions and misassumptions that we have made about some of the most famous stories in sports. Again, the book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, published by 4Edge. And Sheldon Hirsch, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
And it's good to be talking to someone who makes their home not too far away. You now live in Wilmette, but you call yourself still a New York Yankees fan.
Yes, yes. We're almost neighbors.
Right. You talk in the introduction about your love of sports beginning when you were just 7 years old. What was going on when you were seven that ignited your interest in sports?
Well, my dad was a sports fanatic. He was a calculus professor, a statistician, and a Yankee fan going back to Babe Ruth. I grew up with a slide rule and box scores. We learned that you wake up in the morning, you read all the box scores, never miss one. And I've actually done that ever since. The early 60s in New York, where I grew up, was an amazing time for sports. The Yankees were in the World Series every year. The football Giants were in the championship game, 1961 to 1963, 3 years running. And even at the end of the decade, the Knicks, who were historically a terrible team, won the NBA championship. And there was great stuff going on there. My first sports memory actually is the 1962 World Series, which in one of the least remembered incredible events ended with a tying run on third base, two outs in the ninth inning of Game 7. and Willie McCovey of the Giants hitting a line drive about 100 miles or more an hour that just happened to go right at Yankee second baseman Bobby Richardson, rather than a foot above his head or a foot to the side, so the Yankees won the World Series. And that was an incredible way to be introduced to sports. It's the kind of thing that makes us lifelong fans.
Right. One thing that is interesting is that you talk about how your life as a doctor, as a nephrologist, and so your the way in which you have been steeped in science, at least in your professional life, has had a lot to do with the way that you think about sports beyond just, you know, kind of simple fandom. You say the academic training that I've had has influenced my thinking about sports. Tell us how.
Well, to start, I talked about my dad. My mom was a debate coach. So I grew up in a house where we were taught that having contrary opinions was fine. Looking at evidence was a good thing to do, and we learned how to present our own opinions and evidence. And then as I got older, I first became a scientist. I was in molecular biology, and then eventually, as you said, became a kidney doctor. And one of the things you really learn in science, and you learn this as for a long time I wrote scientific and medical papers, is what I call a healthy skepticism. So you're taught in science and medicine that when someone makes a claim about something, your first reaction shouldn't be, okay, wow, that's great, that's certainly true, but rather, as I said, to have some skepticism, to say, okay, well, what's the evidence behind that? Is it really true? Let's examine that evidence very carefully. Let's make sure all evidence that can be brought to bear is brought to bear. Is there contrary evidence? Are there other ideas? And that's something that's drilled into you in science and medicine. So after a long time of learning that, I basically went back to my first love and maybe even my greatest love, my most longstanding love, which is sports. And I applied my debate training and my scientific training to thinking about, as you mentioned, many of the events and athletes and deeds in sports history, and also as they evolved. A lot of the book is really current events, things that happened in the last year or two, where I sat there listening to what people were saying about them, what conventional wisdom was, and asking myself, I wouldn't say from a scientific point of view, but from a thinking that I learned in science, is this true?
And of course, that's something that maybe the typical sports fan is perhaps not inclined to do. I mean, that particular question, maybe it's a scary question, or some regard it as an irrelevant question, or just never dawns on them, but that it doesn't hurt to ask a question as basic as that, even when we're talking about something as relatively inconsequential as sports.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think we do that with things that are actually more consequential than sports. Cognitive psychologists have talked about something called the illusion of expertise. And what that means is that when people who have at least a veneer or even real expertise tell us something, we tend to just back off and accept their expertise as the be-all and end-all. When in fact experts, particularly when it comes to predictive power, are often just as wrong as anybody else.
We're speaking with Sheldon Hirsch, and we're talking about his new book, which is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. In just a moment, I want us to spend some time talking about the specific myth that is mentioned in your title, namely the famous 56-game hitting streak by baseball legend Joe DiMaggio. First, I want to ask you how you came up with the myths and legends that you explore in this book. Are these all matters that had already occurred to you a long time ago, but you just gathered them all up and talked about all of them in a book, or did you have a couple of them already in mind and then sort of sit down and think about, now what are some other legends or myths in sports that are worth debunking? I mean, have you been walking around sort of frustrated by all of these legends all of these years?
Well, I think I have had other things to do.
Right.
But I think it's all of the above. So some of these things have been ideas that I've had in the back of my mind for a long time. For example, the DiMaggio exaltation has nagged at me for a while. Then I sat down as the book kind of developed and thought, well, what other things like are there? And then the third part of that is, as I think I just mentioned, as I was writing the book, things happen in the world of sports that were given certain interpretations or conventional wisdoms or didactic evaluations. And as I sat there and thought about it, I said, geez, that really isn't true. Now, obviously, there are things that are said about sports events that are true. But this book took the things that I found were questionable and put them together into one book.
So let's talk about this winning streak that leads off the book, namely the 56-game hitting streak of Joe DiMaggio. That is, he managed to get a hit in 56 consecutive games. And as you quite rightly say, this tends to be remembered in the same breath as Wilt Chamberlain scoring 100 points in a single game, or Bob Beamon shattering the broad jump record at the Mexico City Olympics in 1968, or 92 goals in one season by Wayne Gretzky. We think of Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak in the same way. You suggest that while this was indeed impressive, this achievement does not deserve to be thought of in quite such grandiose terms. Explain mathematically what people are missing when they think about this hitting streak.
Okay, so let me first stress, as you said, that by conventional measures, this certainly was a great feat of hitting. DiMaggio hit .408 with 15 home runs over the 56 games, and there's no denying that. But the question is, why have we almost histrionically elevated this to an epic deed? Many people call it the greatest achievement in baseball history, or worse yet, from my perspective, the greatest achievement in all of sports. And in particular, we should note that there have been several 56-game sequences by other baseball players that were clearly superior to DiMaggio's. For example, George Brett, Rogers Hornsby, and Ted Williams all hit between .440 and .480 over 56-game sequences. And best of all, this is really interesting, I think, over the exact same time period that DiMaggio had his 56-game hitting streak, he wasn't even the best hitter in baseball. Over that exact same period, Ted Williams hit higher with a much higher on-base plus slugging percentage. So the question arises, why do we do this, or how do we elevate DiMaggio's streak above these other sequences that by traditional measures seem superior? And there are several aspects to the argument that people make, but let me concentrate on the what I think is the most important, which and certainly the most fundamental, which is the idea that DiMaggio's streak alone was consecutive, that the other streaks were not. So now we have to ask ourselves, what is it about consecutive that elevates something, and how does that apply to the DiMaggio streak? Well, in theory, consecutive nature could be a very beneficial thing. I'll give one example. If a baseball team gets 9 hits in a game, 1 hit in an inning, they may get 0 runs and lose the game. On the other hand, if those 9 hits are consecutive in one inning, they will score 6, 7, 8 runs. And that's an instance where the items that are consecutive relate to each other enhance each other, and the whole is far greater than the sum of the parts. However, that does not apply to DiMaggio's streak. The games were consecutive, but the hits, the items of interest, were not. It's kind of a tortured definition of consecutiveness in which the items that are important are not consecutive and are not related to each other. The hits are separated by 5, 6, 7 at-bats. And to give one example of the significance of that, if DiMaggio had not gotten a hit in his 27th game and had hitting streaks of 27 and 28, from the Yankees' perspective, that would have been 99.9% as good as what he actually did.
In terms of the difference it made to the team.
In terms of difference it made to the team. It would have been one less hit in 223 at-bats. Nobody would have noticed one less hit, except by virtue of getting that one nearly irrelevant hit in the 27th game, the streak got transformed from something we wouldn't have noticed and never would have remembered to the great feat of all time.
Right. The other point that that can be made here is that Joe DiMaggio could have had 20 more hits than he did in that season. But if there had been one game where he didn't hit anything at all, then, of course, this streak would not exist at all. So, in kind of both directions, one can mathematically think about, in a sense, the artificiality of this record, for as impressive as it is. And one has a sense of actually how little it says, or the fact that it says a lot less about the difference he made to this team than in fact he did.
Yes, if he had not only not gotten a hit in the 27th game, but gotten two more hits in the 28th game, that would have helped the Yankees more than getting a hit in the 27th game and now having this sort of what really is a statistical idiosyncrasy more than a benefit to the team, the idea that hit in every game.
As you say at one point, this is a matter of baseball treating zero as hugely different from one, treating that as a bigger difference than in fact it is.
Yeah, and that's something that comprises the nature of streaks, and I think it is exaggerating the importance of zero. So I'll give you another example of that. Perfect games are basically another form of a consecutive streak. It's getting 27 batters out in a row. And when a pitcher pitches a perfect game, we exalt that, and properly so. You can't possibly do better. But I would keep in mind that getting 26 out of 27 batters, a one-hitter, is 99% as good as a perfect game, yet we don't remember one-hitters. We don't they're yesterday's news by tomorrow. And that's kind of an exaggeration of the difference between zero and one.
Right. And of course, the point here is that we end up focused too much on things that ultimately don't make a real difference as much as we think we do. I mean, in a sense, it proves to be an entertaining and amusing distraction, but it's a distraction that, in a sense, keeps us from missing what's really going on and what really matters the most when it comes to a team winning or losing.
I think that's true. And I think one of the reasons why we love streaks, like hitting streaks or perfect games, is the melodrama. There's kind of a drumbeat every day. Did DiMaggio get a hit? Did he not get a hit? And that lasts over the 2 months of the streak. Every batter, is the perfect game still going? Has the perfect game been broken up? Now, by the way, I think that's great. I mean, one of the reasons we love sports is because of the drama. So the drama of a hitting streak, somebody is up to, 27 games, 28 games, 29 games. He's getting closer to DiMaggio's streak. That's fantastic. That's greatly enjoyable. But we shouldn't confuse that with, or we shouldn't hyperbolize the value of the streak just because it's so enjoyable and so dramatic.
Right. And, of course, we have to be on guard for the fact that it is in the interest of people who write for newspapers and people who put together television sportscasts to hype these very things that we're talking about. I mean, it is in their interest to make these sorts of things a bigger deal than in fact they should be.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, by the way, and I'll say something that may be really controversial, our fixation with zero and with streaks can be harmful. So think about this. Cal Ripken very famously played in 2,600-something games in a row. And by all means, great kudos to Cal Ripken. I mean, that was a feat of stamina, of strength of will, of physical strength. Fantastic. But to keep that streak going, he clearly played in games when he was exhausted, when he was injured, when if he didn't have the streak going, he would have sat out. So he played in games he otherwise would not have played in just to keep the streak going. And you could easily make the argument that if Cal Ripken had sat out even three games in the 2,600 games, he would have come back stronger and helped the Orioles more than he did. And if he had sat out three games, the difference between 2,597 games and 2,600 games is zero. It's infinitesimal. It's irrelevant. Yet we would never have remembered it because it didn't comprise a consecutive streak.
Hmm. I want to ask you about a different matter that is also part of this first section of the book in which you focus on the sport of baseball. It's where you talk about our propensity not only to create heroes like Joe DiMaggio, even if sometimes we do so by fixating on certain things that maybe don't fully merit that sort of fixation, but we also like to create goats. And I think you really do a great job of helping us understand why we are inclined to create goats. And one of the best examples I think you share about this is with the unfortunate moment in the career of Bill Buckner. And so, first of all, remind our listeners, I remember seeing this on TV, but remind our listeners who either didn't see it or have forgotten what happened to him in the 1986 World Series, and then why you think it is the inclination of so many fans to treat this error on the field the way they do.
Okay, so it's the game six, the ninth inning of the 1986 World Series, the Boston Red Sox and the New York Mets. And the Red Sox, remember, have not won a World Series since 68 years. And the Red Sox are up in the ninth inning. And to make a long story short, Mookie Wilson of the Mets hits a routine ground ball to first baseman Bill Buckner, who doesn't bend over. The ball goes through his legs into right field. The Mets score the tying run. They go on to win the game in extra innings, and then they go on to win the seventh game. So the Red Sox streak of not winning a World Series stays existing even beyond 68 years. And Bill Buckner got blamed for losing the World Series. In fact, worse than that, he got vilified. He became persona non grata in Boston, including death threats, to the point where eventually he had to flee New England, and he ended up moving to Utah. And the one good part of about this is that it was such a fixation on Bill Buckner as the GOAT that Jerry Seinfeld made an episode about it, basically caricaturizing New England fans and rehabbing Bill Buckner in one of the funniest Seinfeld episodes ever. So for those who are fans of that show. So the question then is, was Bill Buckner really the GOAT? And if not, why did Red Sox and New England fans mischaracterize him as the GOAT? Now, it's pretty easy to argue that Buckner was not the GOAT. I mean, obviously, he did miss the ground ball, and that did cause the tying run. But the reality is the Red Sox messed up from beginning to end. There were a series of bad decisions and bad plays by multiple people that were all necessary for the Red Sox to lose. Buckner's was just one of them. So, for example, let's start off with, why was Buckner still in the game? He wasn't a good defensive player. They were ahead late in the game. Why didn't manager John McNamara remove him? Secondly, the Red Sox had the lead with two outs in the ninth inning and two strikes on several batters, and relief pitcher Calvin Schiraldi couldn't get the third out on any of them. Then Bob Stanley comes in and throws a wild pitch, which let the run score. And then they're up three runs in the seventh inning of Game 7, and Bruce Hurst can't hold the lead. Then they have the tying run on second base, and three different batters can't knock in the tying run. And here's the best one of all. Let's go back to Game 6. The Red Sox are winning. They have one of the greatest pitchers in the history of baseball, Roger Clemens, on the mound, and they take him out of the game after the seventh inning. And the manager, McNamara, says that Clemens asked out of the game because he had a blister on his fingertip. Now imagine that. You got Jack Morris pitch 10 innings in a Game 7 shutout to win a World Series. You have Curt Schilling, who pitched a playoff game for the Red Sox, bleeding from a sutured ankle tendon. And you have Roger Clemens asking out of the season-ending game to blister. Now, you want a GOAT? That's unbelievable. Now, Clemens, by the way, in his defense, denied it. He said that McNamara pinch hit for him basically as a strategic decision. And if that's the case, McNamara's the GOAT. How do you take a Hall of Fame pitcher out of a winning game in the seventh inning, in the eighth inning of Game 6 of the World Series? So there's the bottom line is McNamara or Clemens, there's all sorts of blame to go around. The Red Sox team basically fell apart. And I think there are two reasons why Buckner got labeled the GOAT. First, Red Sox fan, it's a kind of salve. It's easier for people to blame one person than their team. Red Sox fans love their team, and for good reason. And to say that the team was great, but this one guy blew it, is a lot easier on the soul than to say the whole team fell apart.
Right. As you say, singling out Buckner for blame as with Mouch turns a multifaceted collapse into a more satisfying, simple story. By explaining the losses as due to one person's failings, Red Sox and Phillies fans avoided the harsher reality that their beloved teams collectively fell apart. It's a way for us to soften the blow when something disappointing has occurred to a team that we really, really love. We find comfort in being able to pin the blame on an isolated figure who did something wrong versus a more systemic issue that led to the collapse.
Right, exactly. It's fascinating. You mentioned there the antecedent part to the Buckner story, which was the Phillies. And a really nearly identical concept happened. The 64 Phillies had a huge lead in the pennant with about 10 games left. And then, without going through all the details, their manager, Gene Mauch, made a couple of controversial moves that didn't work out. And he became the Bill Buckner of 1964. In fact, Gene Mauch's name remains an expletive in Philadelphia today. as the GOAT of the 1964 pennant race. But if you go back and look at that at the end of the season, game by game, which I did, it turns out that just like with the Red Sox, the Phillies completely fell apart. There were a horde of reasons why they lost. Their pitchers were injured. Their base runners were thrown out on the bases. They couldn't score runs. They made 13 or 14 errors in the last 10 games. I mean, almost everybody fell apart. Yet Gene Mauch was labeled as the single GOAT and the reason why the Phillies lost.
I know we have to let you go pretty quick here, but in the last couple of minutes, I want you to talk quickly about something that's in your chapter devoted to basketball, and something that comes up all the time, not only in basketball, but in other sports as well, namely losses being attributed to lack of effort. And in this particular case, you're pointing to a disappointing season by the Chicago Bulls and the inclination for various sportscasters and, for that matter, officials of the team to chalk it up to just a general lack of effort by the players. And you really call this malarkey. Say a word about this, why we tend to like to talk in these terms and why it's a mistake to do so.
Well, I actually think this is a similar thing to the Gene Mauch and Bill Buckner story, where we take a complicated situation and we find a soothing single explanation. So we don't like to say that our teams are not good enough, and coaches and managers don't like to say that our teams are not good enough, that they just lost to a better team. So very commonly, when a team loses, you almost always read, and I cited a number of examples of this over a couple seasons of the Chicago Bulls, that they lost because they didn't try hard enough. It's always the other team wanted it more. They got the loose balls. They got the rebounds. We didn't bring it today. We need to try harder tomorrow. You never hear a coach in a post-game conference saying, my team tried so hard, I'm proud of them. It's just that the other team is better. There's one memorable exception in the NBA, which I remembered and included, which I thought was kind of neat, was Doug Moe of the Denver Nuggets. Doug was a kind of charismatic, shoot-from-the-hip kind of figure. And the Nuggets were meeting the L.A. Lakers at a time when the Lakers were nearly unbeatable. And the Nuggets were the eighth seed and the Lakers were the first seed. And before the series began, Moe said to the press, we have no chance to win a single game. They're just too good. And, in fact, they got swept. Now, I'm not sure his players appreciated his candor, but that stood in contradistinction to what we hear all the time, which is that our team is great, but it just didn't try hard enough. And I think that is, to use the word, malarkey. Most games are won by the better team.
That plays better.
that plays better, exactly. In fact, they may not be the better team, but they simply played better. And it wasn't necessarily because they're morally superior or character superior people. Everybody's trying hard. Some guys just play better, and that team wins.
Right. My favorite sport of tennis, one sees this all the time. And I think particularly in sports where it's one-on-one, it's very easy to fall into this kind of pattern. I mean, as though player A wanted to win Wimbledon more than player B did on the other side of the net. That never made
right.
sense to me. But I think you really take that apart very persuasively in your great book. Again, your book is called Hot Hands, Draft Hype, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, published by 4Edge, and the author, Sheldon Hirsch. Sheldon Hirsch, thanks for this interesting book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program. and we'll be talking about the EcoJustice Farm Corps program on Friday. I'm excited to speak with the author of a wonderful and illuminating book called Dog is Love. It is the author's exploration of a very fundamental question for anybody who owns a dog. Do our dogs love us? And what is the nature of that love, if indeed we can call it love? It's a really wonderful book, and we'll be sharing the interview with the author on Friday's morning show. We remind you that the morning show is now available as a podcast via Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.